I knew it. Great to see everyone. If you turn over to Luke chapter 9, or we can just cancel the study and have a whole lot more fun, you know, just talking. Well, no, I don't think we'd have more fun. But anyway, great to see everyone. Luke chapter 9. We'll begin our study in verse 28, and looking at the transfiguration of Jesus. A lot to be understood here. Luke covers a lot in his, talks about some things that we do not see in the other accounts, so that will make it even more interesting to see how Luke addresses the transfiguration. All right, before we begin, let's start with prayer. Father, thank you for blessing us this day. Thank you for giving us this time. We so appreciate your watchful care. Help us as we study your word to see your glory in this beautiful text. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, let's just read the whole section here, which will go down through verse 36. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, he took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered, and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah," not knowing what he said. As he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them. And they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him." And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen. All right. This incident just appears suddenly as Luke is recounting things. And remember, we're just leading up to this major division in Luke's account. He has been telling us who Jesus is in every chapter up to this point. He's just introducing him, showing who he is all the way here. And now it's just kind of a climactic picture. This is who he is. And then when we get more toward the end of chapter 9, he's going to transition to talk about who disciples are and how disciples are to follow him. So you're going to mainly see that right there. So this thing, I want to do right now is let's just talk about anything you see in this text. What do you see here that has stood out to you? And I think sooner or later we'll cover everything that's there. But there's a whole lot there. So just go ahead and give it to me.
It comes across as a miraculous counseling session.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? They're talking about what's going to happen to him and something that's already happened to Moses and Elijah, which are great things that happened to them. And it's like he's counseling them. Not that Jesus didn't know.
Yeah, so a counseling session between Jesus, Moses, and Elijah. Yeah, yeah. The interesting thing that Luke tells us that Matthew and Mark do not tell us is that they're actually talking. They're having a discussion, and they're having discussion about Jesus' upcoming death. That's just crazy. It really is something we have to explore. Mara.
I have a comment.
Uh-huh.
Know who Moses and Elijah are?
Well, of course, we can't, we don't really know, obviously. Does he know who Moses and Elijah are? My guess would be that he has some knowledge of that, you know, but we're just guessing. At any rate, and these would be pretty, of course, Moses and Elijah would be pretty famous, well-known if you had any knowledge. Obviously, a lot of what Luke talks about in the book of Acts, when he speaks of Gentiles, he speaks of Greek believing Gentiles, or those who are individual Gentiles who came to the synagogue and listened to the words. And so if Theophilus is anywhere in that category, then he would know some of those things. And then, you know, what does it do for Theophilus? Well, it's going to do the same thing for Theophilus as it's going to do for us.
I was going to say, verse 22, Jesus just let it be known that he was going to be raised. And they were probably questioning, well, how's that going to be? And
yeah.
We see Moses and Elijah still alive, still present there. So there's some kind of connection teaching us that there's life after death.
Yeah, okay, good. I had never thought of that connection. That's a great connection. He's just talked about how he's going to die and raise, and then they see his glory, and Moses and Elijah with him, who are obviously still live.
Twice earlier in this chapter, people have equated Jesus with wondering if he was Elijah, and so now they're seeing Jesus with Elijah, so there's no doubt that this is not Elijah.
Good. Very, very important principle there. There has been a questioning. This is a great contrast between here and then back in verses 18 and following, when he says, "Who do people say that I am?" And the crowds are like all over the place. It's Elijah. It's one of the prophets. It's all of this. And so now you have the transfiguration. Now think of what Theophilus is learning there. He's certainly getting this clarified. Now, this is not one of the prophets. This is not, Elijah would stand for the greatest of all the prophets. He's not one of the prophets. He's not Moses. He's not anybody back there. This is truly God's chosen one, God's son. And there's really a marked difference there, and that's solidifying that. So that's a really good connection. You always want to see those strong connections there. Very good. Okay? So that is important. What else is important here? Just throwing facts out on the table. Yeah.
In verse 31, the language what will come in Jerusalem is not heavy, it's not problematic, it's what will Jesus accomplish in Jerusalem, which is that language is not how most of us would speak about a painful death and scourging and harsh trial. But instead, with these men, Christ is using the language of accomplishment. And it's a forward-looking sort of thing.
Yes. They're talking about his departure. And if you have noticed, Mara mentioned this, but if you have noticed, maybe in your footnote in some of your Bibles, the word in the Greek there is his exodus. And as Adam said, you would not normally think of people talking that way about their death. In fact, Jesus didn't talk that way about his death when he predicted it just earlier in this chapter. But in this particular case, they're talking about his upcoming exodus. So as Mara pointed out, there's a lot of parallels here between the exodus period of the Old Testament. You have Moses, you have the cloud. Moses went up into a cloud on the mountain. You have this emphasis of glory. Moses' face shone, which was showing the glory of God, reflecting the glory of God. Well, here is now Jesus then taking on and actually seeing. He's appearing to him in his glory, and he's seeing his glory. So very, very similar to when Moses said, could we see, when Moses asked God, can I see you? Can I see your glory? And God says, well, you can't see my face, etc. So you see this glorified state. You'd almost say it's as close as you could get to seeing Jesus as God truly that you could get without vaporizing, but not exactly there, obviously. Chip.
I also think in verse 31, it's in, for me anyway, interesting that Moses and Elijah are alive.
Yes.
And I know this is about the book of John, but in John chapter 8, when they speak of Moses, Jesus says, "Before Moses was, I am." And so this is probably a bit of a confirmation, not a revelation, for the apostles who saw this, because if there was any doubt, it would be quenched here that these people were, individuals in their history lived.
Yeah, it's really just something to that little part of the scene, I think, is just a lot to contemplate. Moses and Elijah, they're alive. Of course, Elijah didn't die. He just went straight up. But they're both alive. They are cognizant about what is about to take place, it seems. They're having this conversation. Anything else you guys think of just with that? What else kind of comes to mind when you think of that?
If you just think about being in the presence of these three individuals, life, it's just mind-boggling.
Yes.
And I'm sure Peter and James and John were rebuffed. It's enough to, you wonder where you are.
Yeah, it just blow you away. And you know, Peter's words are pretty good right there. He says, "It's good for us to be here." Indeed. You think? This is amazing of what we're able to comprehend and see here. Moses, of course, representation of the law. Elijah, representation of the prophets. So these two represent everything in the Old Testament period and yet are alive. What else is amazing just about that little part, Michael?
Maybe not answering.
Well, go ahead.
It's interesting that it seems like Moses and Elijah don't really introduce themselves to three men.
That's what I was going to say.
And yet they don't know. Like, they don't have name tags, you can see Moses.
Of course they
do. So, it's interesting that they know who they are without meeting them.
Exactly. That's what boggles my mind. Which may give us a bit of a glimpse of when we enter into glory with them, we will know everyone. And we will know all of us. I just think of the high fives. We're here. We made it. All of that, you know the prophets, you know everyone. And it's a pretty unique scene, Adam.
I do think that this is one of those times when their encounter was likely much longer than 8 verses, how long it takes is 3 8 verses. Mm-hmm. And so, while I agree with Michael, it's interesting that we're not told how they know them, we also don't, I think, fully understand what it means in verse 32 when they become fully awake and they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. It takes us, 15 seconds to read that sentence.
Right.
But that's likely a much longer time. And so part of how they likely come to know that it's Moses and Elijah is they are witnessing something that is conversational at minimum.
Yeah.
And potentially includes them at some point in some ways that they know these things.
They're listening in on a conversation and can figure it out. And, sure.
Right. Okay. It's not just it takes us 2 minutes to read these verses. This is an evening.
Right. Yeah, that's neat. There's so many of these kinds of things. You can't wait to see the video on it. see what it really looked like. But yeah, lot of interesting things there, and certainly a confirmation of life after death and life with God and with the Lord, as Paul would talk about, depart and be with Christ. A lot of emphasis even on that, and confirmation on that, that is helpful just for us. It's not the purpose necessarily primarily of the text, but just all the side notes that you can come away from is pretty cool. Okay? Yeah, Teresa?
I just thought it was interesting that it refers to Elijah and Moses as the men were departing from, not as the spirits were departing.
Okay, from, yeah. Yeah, as these men were departing from them. Yeah.
Picture them walking away.
Yeah, vaporizing. Something like that. Yeah. But all of this, and I think the most important connection was, as is mentioned, all of this connection with these Old Testament men. Elijah goes up on a mountain as well. Moses, of course, up on a mountain. The lawgiver, the prophet, all of these, and yet Jesus is seen. Of course, the end result is, after Peter says, "Let's make three tents," the voice from heaven saying, "This is my son, this is my chosen one, listen to him." So there's that transition that is from listening to Moses, listening to the prophets. Now, here is the ultimate fulfillment of this. Listen to him. Do you remember the prophecy that God uttered through Moses back in Deuteronomy 18? That's a very, very important prophecy. We might just take a look at that right quick, so that you have that in your mind real well. But in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 15, Moses tells the people, and this is, of course, Deuteronomy rehearsing what had taken place. You might remember in Exodus 20, the people were very afraid when God spoke from heaven and said, "Please don't ask God not to talk to us that way anymore, because it's just too scary." And God had replied, "Yes, that's good. I will then send a prophet." And here is Moses rehearsing that. "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen." So that is prophetic, of course, not just of Jesus, but of all the prophets leading up to Jesus. But it is ultimately a profession of the Messiah. And everybody understood that. Everybody recognized that. That passage is quoted a couple more times. It's quoted by Peter when he gives his sermon in Acts chapter 3. So this is a very, very important connection, and Jesus then is the ultimate fulfillment. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1 and 2. God spoke in sundry times in various manners in time past, but now has spoken to us in these last days, spoken to us by his Son, whom he's appointed heir of all things, by whom he made the worlds. And so you see that transition from God spoke this way in the past, now he speaks through his Son. So this is the ultimate revelation, and that's what Hebrews keeps saying. Since it's the ultimate revelation from the actual Son of God, the appointed title is that he is Son, giving him the highest title he could give him, that because of that, you must give more careful attention to the things that you have heard, lest you let them drift away, because in Old Testament times, every transgression, every disobedience received a just recompense of a reward. How will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation that has been delivered us to us by the Lord? That's Hebrews chapter 2, 1 through 3. So you keep getting that emphasis. We have this much greater revelation, therefore a much greater responsibility, and we have to give much greater care to listening even than they did in the Old Testament, even though every transgression received a just recompense in them. So unlike, off here a little bit, but unlike... Well, it's not off. Unlike those today would say the God of the Old Testament was mean and strict and all that. And in the New Testament, he's nice and not so strict. That's not the message of Hebrews. That is not the message that God is giving over and over again. And it's certainly not the message that is given in the gospel accounts, where people like even Sodom and Gomorrah and others will stand up in judgment against those of this day because there is a greater one who has come and they have not repented. So, great warning there. All right, anything else on that? Just on that point, yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting that there's a cloud that leads to Exodus and the cloud.
Yeah. Exactly. You have all kinds of parallels there. And if we don't see those parallels, then we don't appreciate that those of the first century, whether Theophilus or whoever else, those of the first century would make those connections. And that is exactly what goes on over and over again. Those connections to the Old Testament are very important because God has to get across to the people that we have transitioned from the Mosaical and prophetical period to the end times. That's the way they saw that, and it's the way the scriptures speak of it. Daniel speaks of this period of time as the end times. Well, if that's the end times, where are we? Closer than ever. Isn't that great? Just closer than ever. So this is it. This is the culmination of everything God had planned before time began. What an honor to live at the culmination of all these things, and also what a challenge to make sure that we don't take it lightly. Pretty cool. Okay? So a lot of really neat things. Somebody else, Chip.
Mm-hmm. I think, I don't want you to get off on a tangent, but since Hebrews ties in here, it really is interesting to me that God declares him his son, and comparing that to in Hebrews, that God appointed a son.
A son.
And it's a nuance, but it's an important nuance.
It is.
God declares him here to be that son.
Yes.
The chosen one, as he names it here. And that's just an interesting, I think, affirmation of what's being taught in Hebrews about the uniqueness of this sonship.
And that, you know, Chip brings something up, and just a reminder for those of you who may not have been in the Hebrew studies three or whatever years ago it was, but remember that sonship here is an appointed title. This is so helpful to understand that when God speaks of Jesus, or as Jesus speaks of himself as the Son, we think of father-son kind of relationship, and the old King James says, my only begotten Son, as if God beget him in some human earthly kind of way. Not so. It is an appointed title, and those in the ancient Near Eastern world would understand this as a title given that is as high as it could be. There's no greater title. Even Pharaoh speaks of Joseph as like a son. Joseph speaks of his relationship with Pharaoh. Pharaoh is like a father to me, and I a son. He's appointed me as the greatest in Egypt, and nothing is done without me. Joseph is a parallel to that. So it's a high title. Can you think of the psalm you would go to always show that he is the, this day I have begotten you, the resurrection and enthronement of Jesus? What psalm is that? This is definitely, can't go to heaven without this. When you get to judgment, he's going to ask, what psalm? Psalm 2, exactly. Psalm 2. Psalm 2 is quoted just like so many times. It's alluded to so many times, it's just like almost uncountable. Psalm 2 is a critical key to who Jesus is. He is set on the throne. He is begotten to be the Son. Paul says that happens through the resurrection. He's declared to be the Son of God by the resurrection. Romans chapter 1, verse 4. This is just alluded to oodles and oodles of times. And Psalm 2 is just critical. And then he conquers the nations, and the nations are warned, you better kiss the son, lest he be angry with you. He's going to crush the nations with a rod of iron. The whole book of Revelation comes out of Psalm 2. Woohoo. You can just read Revelation, go Psalm 2, Psalm 2, Psalm 2, Psalm 2, all the way through. The apostles quote Psalm 2 when they pray in Acts chapter 4. It just keeps coming up. So that you want to notice that. You want to see that royal, this is what it is, it's a royal title there that Jesus is given. And the apostles now listening to those words, this is my chosen one. Look, by the way, at Isaiah 44. 42. Isaiah 42, and just notice 1 through 4, which would reference then this idea of the chosen one. Isaiah 44. And he says, verse 1, "But now hear, O Jacob, my servant, Israel, whom I have chosen. Thus says the Lord, who made you, who formed you from the womb, and will help you. Fear not, O Jacob, my servant, Jeshurun, whom I have chosen. For I will pour water." That's, I'm reading 44. Why did I do that? 42, "Behold my servant," there we are, "whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry aloud, lift his voice, or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his law." So you see then all of these passages in the Old Testament are spoken of and fulfilled when God says what he says concerning Jesus. So seize that. All right, what, anything else? Yeah.
This reminds me of John's baptism.
Okay. Yeah, it does.
I don't know what the comparison
is. But that's true. You know, when he's baptized, the voice from heaven says, "This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased," or "I am pleased with." And that is also comes out of Isaiah. He's the one who is going to be pleasing to God. He's one who is going to fulfill what the nation of Israel, God's other servant, did not do. So Jesus is the ultimate servant. Remember in Isaiah, there's four servants. There's servant songs, and there's these four servants. And so you have the servant physical Israel who fails. And then you have the servant Cyrus, who is the king who is going to come and deliver his people, literally. Deliver God's people out of bondage and captivity. And then you have the servant, Jesus, the suffering servant, the Messiah, who redeems the people and ultimately delivers them. Then you have all of us, you know, who are the servants of the Messiah, and he produces us through his offspring. So you see all of those. We are then both Jesus, the suffering servant, and us fulfill what the physical Israel servant failed to do. We always need to remember that. We don't want to be like them who failed their purpose. And that's, you know, that's what we've been seeing in the book of 1 Peter. A lot of references to this. We are the chosen ones now. We are the elect. He's chosen. We're chosen. Everything that happens to him happens to us. Everything he goes through, we go through. That's why we can't avoid suffering. We can't be ashamed of him, as he talked about earlier in this chapter. All of these things because we're going through what he went through. And that's how we get to glory. Do you notice the word glory in the text? So you should see the word glory. They saw his glory. He appeared in glory. Pretty cool. Richard.
Seems like to me this is all in the same context.
Yeah, it's always interesting that he chooses Peter, James, and John to come with him. We already noticed this earlier when the 12-year-old girl was healed. He just brings them into the room. He wants them to see. It's just because these three were the dullest of all of them, and they just needed to see more, you know. I'm going to say that right up. I hope they're listening. You know, maybe we'll have a little conversations about that. They'll back me around a little bit. No, you know, who knows? You could say that maybe that, or you could say the Lord knew that they would be very prominent, and they were going to be writers in the New Testament. Of course, James, brother of John, is not going to write, but they would be very prominent. And they were going to have the strength needed. So while you bring that up, Richard, why don't we just take a look at the parallel passage of this where Peter speaks about this. 2 Peter chapter 1. 2 Peter chapter 1. And notice beginning at verse 16. 2 Peter 1, 16. But Peter draws some really neat conclusions here. From this. For we did not follow. Now, this gives you an idea of the kind of false teachers that Peter is dealing with. We did not follow cleverly devised myths, earlier versions, fables, when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. But we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. And you see that? For when he received honor and glory from God the Father, and the voice was borne to him by the majestic glory, "This is my beloved Son, and with whom I am well pleased," we ourselves heard this very voice born from heaven, for we were with him on the holy mountain. And we have the prophetic word made more fully confirmed, to which you will do well to pay attention, etc. So Peter's argument is, we were not telling you some kind of fable when we told you about Jesus. Of course, Peter's writing to people who never saw Jesus. It would be over 30 years since that time. And he's writing to these people who have become Christians, scattered throughout the northern Asia Minor area, as we have seen in 1 Peter. And he's telling them, we actually saw him. We actually saw him in his glory on that mountain. We heard the voice of God say, "This is my beloved Son." And that confirms more fully the prophetic word is true. And you need to trust what the prophecies have said and trust what was happening and trust that Jesus is the Son of God. You know, isn't that, that's pretty cool, and it's still good today. Think of all the people who run around talking about, you know, revelations and God talked to me and all this other stuff. And here's John does it in 1 John. Peter does it here. Paul does it in 1 Corinthians. They said, just stop it. We saw him. We heard the voice of God from heaven. Why are you believing anybody else? Listen. We have been given the words of God. You do not listen to them. We were eyewitnesses. We heard the voice. We saw the glory. It's real powerful evidence. It's just strong evidence today as it was then. Because we didn't see any more than they saw. It wouldn't matter if you were in the first century and didn't see Jesus, or you're living today and didn't see Jesus. You have to have some eyewitness testimony and evidence. And we both have the same eyewitness testimony and evidence. So seeing his majesty and glory, I'm going to throw something else at you here. I keep running across people who, mostly in the church, but who will say, well, you know, when Jesus raised from the dead, and he's appearing different places, and, you know, and he's in a body and all that, that's what, I know I brought this up before, but we're going to have a body like Jesus did when he raised, you know, from the tomb and was able just to boop, 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 you know, zip around, go through locked doors and appear. And we're going to be like that. We're going to have a body like that. It's going to be an earthly body just like we have, but it's going to be a body that now is perfected and healed, and we can do anything. So 1 John 3:2. I know I brought this up to you, but I want to keep hammering it because I don't want you to be fooled by some who are talking this way. 1 John 3, verse 2. John, the apostle, who was there, who saw his glory, says, "Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is." All right. Did John see Jesus in glory on the mountain? He did. He saw him transfigured, made into a different form, and all of those things. And John right here, even in that form, which was different than his earthly physical form after he raised from the dead, even that form, John said, we don't know what we will be. Well, John, you saw him. Well, what I saw is not what we're going to be, because what I saw is not what he really is. It was just a picture. So John saw Jesus after he raised from the dead, and John saw Jesus up on the holy mountain, transfigured in glory, and yet John says here, what we will be has not yet appeared. And we don't know what that's going to be, but we do know when he appears, we'll be like him, we'll see him as he is. And Philippians 3, verse 20 and 21 says, we will have a body like his glorious body. It is not something we know about yet. 1 Corinthians 15, we will be planted in dishonor, physical form. We'll be raised in, the word again, glory. There is an earthly body and there is a heavenly body. Paul makes that very clear in 1 Corinthians 15. At any rate, yeah, like somebody said one time, well, you know, there's that Jeremiah talks about, you know, like old men going through the streets downtown. You don't have to worry about anybody attacking him. Only a young person says that. I just got to tell you that. Only a young person says that. Because if I'm an old man in the new heavens and new earth with a cane walking around downtown, glad somebody's not going to attack me, I'm pretty mad. I thought I was going to get the new body. I want to walk around this old body with a cane. And you'll appreciate that when you get our age. So, I don't have a cane yet. But I'll beat you with the cane when I do.
You know, the message to these guys into Theophilus would be a warning about elevating any man to a place they're not supposed to be, because that happens a lot. Even Paul said, even though we or an angel from heaven speak the word of you, it's different from this. We're not supposed to elevate anybody, especially us.
Yeah. That's exactly right. That's a good point. I can think of one other, too, on this. If you're looking at it from first century people, this is an entirely different Messiah than what they expected. Of course, this isn't revealed until after Jesus raises and the apostles start talking about it. They don't talk about it before that. But this is an entirely different Messiah than what anybody would have expected. He hasn't come as an earthly, physical human being who's simply gonna, you know, get on a white horse and ride through Jerusalem and the countryside and conquer the world and bring some kind of earthly kingship. That's just not in the cards here. It's not what the purpose was. All right? Any other questions on this? Yeah, Chip.
I have a question about the cloud. Alan brought it up, but I think we picture it as a cloud that comes over, and sort of like in the tabernacle days, they were led by a cloud that was above them or something, but I seem to remember someone somewhere saying that it would be almost like a cloud enveloped them, like they were in a cloud.
Oh, it seems it says that way, yeah.
Not that it was over
them. Over them, exactly.
Yeah, and I think that that had to be an awfully frightening thing as well, to be in the cloud.
Yeah, I think so too, and that's That's really, again, connects to that Old Testament period when Moses went up into the cloud. And this is maybe even more an affirmation of the importance of what the revelation of the apostles would be following this. Julie. Yes, yes. Now, I'm pretty sure it's either Mark or Matthew's account, I don't remember for sure, but he actually tells them not to tell anybody. So Luke doesn't mention that, but I'm fairly confident that the other accounts actually say, don't go tell anybody what you just saw, not till later. But Peter obviously tells it later because we see it in 2 Peter and stuff like that. So it would have been certainly part of what Peter and these apostles would have used in order to emphasize that they were actually the ones who God has chosen. So a lot of things here that are proved. Got just a couple of minutes, so I'll mention another. His appearance of his face is altered, and then of course Matthew's account transfigured. There's one other time in the Bible where that word is used in the Greek. You may take a wild guess. Romans chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, where he says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. Transformed, okay? Be transfigured, be transformed, be changed into the new form of God. Do not conform to the pictures of this world. Do not conform yourself to the ways of this world. Be transformed into this new image that God is creating for you to be. All right, and then, of course, 2 Corinthians would give the concept as well. 2 Corinthians 3:18, where he says, we now with unveiled face look into the glory of the Lord and are being transformed from one degree of glory to another. So again, that transformation process as we get to know Him. This is the reason it's so important not to just study the Bible to see rules and rights and wrongs and what's the proper side of this issue or that issue. Always read it to see God, so that you can see what He really is and be transformed to look like Him. Again, the reason you read and study all 66 books carefully, because all 66 give you the perfect picture of who God is and what He looks like. If you only know 30 of them, you only have half the picture, not even. And unfortunately, that's often true. So spend as careful a time with a Zephaniah and a Haggai as you would with a Matthew and an Acts. It's very important. Thank you. Good discussion. We'll pick up there next week.